Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. On this episode, what you're going to hear is a conversation I have with Garrett Langley. Now, Garrett is the CEO and co-founder of Flock Safety, a business most recently valued at over $4 billion. And their most recent stats has indicated that they have played a role in solving over 10% of crimes in the United States. Flock is one of the most interesting private companies that I've ever come across. Garrett is a very impressive leader that's been building an important company for society. A really fun conversation that you'll hear now. Garrett, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
So can we bat off maybe with you describing what Flock Safety does?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's an interesting business because at the end of the day, we view ourselves as a crime-fighting company.
It's a noble mission.
Yes. There are like many things in life that I think we should try to fix. Elon is working on a bunch of them. I'd like to think we're like a small version of that. Trying to help at least the people that live on Earth today. And so for us, we're a crime fighting company. Now, the way we do that, though, isn't through traditional means. You know, we're not a law enforcement agency. We're not a nonprofit. You know, we build technology that helps the people who have been tasked with fighting crime do it more effectively, more objectively, and more successfully. The kind of eye-opening thing for me, you know, I have always been an entrepreneur. I've never had like a real job before. And about 7 years ago, when we were trying to figure out what to do next in life, I saw this statistic that I didn't believe was accurate, which is that roughly you've got almost a 90% chance of getting away with stealing someone's car. And I was like, man, that can't be right. You know, like that doesn't seem accurate. And thankfully, in some cities, that is inaccurate, right? That's a national average. That's not the case for, you know, New York. New York actually has a better clearance rate than a lot of cities. But that's kind of what we do. We build technology that helps law enforcement through one way or another solve crime. And the main reason why is when you look at the kind of primary research done by academics, our goal isn't just to solve crime. Our goal is to eliminate crime. And the way you eliminate it is make it harder to do.
It's fascinating. I assume that was a fork in the road of like, do I do crime with a 90% chance of getting away with it? That entrepreneurial pursuit versus do I try to solve crime? I'm glad you landed on the side you did. It sounds like crime itself is a fairly profitable business, at least in terms of the nonviolent stuff.
Yes.
If you have a 90% success rate, I mean, that's way, way higher than I would have guessed. And it's just kind of a troubling stat. I realize that's a national average and, there's a bunch of different inputs into it. But if you were to distill down the reason for that, and I guess just the root of what Flock actually does, like why is the clearance rate so low for solving nonviolent crime?
Yeah, so you bring up a good point. I was actually I was with the mayor of Atlanta last night. They're a great Flock customer, and obviously I live in Atlanta, so I care a lot about what happens in my hometown. And he developed one of these awesome programs. He calls it the Year of the Youth. And what he realized is like, look, we've all been 15 before, right? And in an abundance of free time, you just make not the best decisions. And so what he realized is like, if we create jobs for these kids, they'll be too busy to commit crime. Because you see, most criminals are not evil. They're opportunistic. And some, to your point, are doing it from a profit perspective. But a lot of crime is also due to boredom. Now, maybe you were setting firecrackers off or you're doing something less malicious. But a lot of the crime we see is semi-organized auto theft rings. And it's just, oh, we're 16 and we're goofing off. There's no malintent out of, you know, oh, we're going to go steal this car, which is actually pretty painful. And when you look at it, the reason why it's so hard to solve these crimes is there's never any evidence. If you imagine you're like an SDR, imagine being told like, go book this deal, but I'm not going to give you their phone number, the name of the company, their email address, but I need you to go book this deal. And that's the effective job of your average detective. Hey, this car was stolen. We think it was stolen around 2 a.m. And that's all we have. And that's actually really hard, right? Like how do you go solve that? It's pretty tricky. And so when you look at it, the clearance rates are linearly correlated to the lack of evidence. And I would say lack of objective evidence too. But there was this one case in Tennessee where it was an armed robbery of a vehicle. So the person was held at gunpoint. And when they were held at gunpoint, they said it was a black male in a 49ers hoodie. And they were in a pickup truck. Like a pickup truck pulled up to them, you know, did this thing. And they got two things right in that eyewitness description. The person was wearing a 49ers hoodie. They were driving a truck, but they were actually white.
Hmm.
And look, I don't think that I'm not, you know, I bring this up not to say, oh, that person is like bad. Eyewitness testimony is really hard. Imagine if you were sitting there and then all of a sudden you have a gun to your head. You're not like, oh, am I accurately describing this scenario? You're thinking like, oh my gosh, I want to live through this scenario. And now with Flock, I mentioned the objective piece. That officer in Tennessee was able to go in and say, hey, show me all the pickup trucks in this area around this time. That leads to a license plate, then leads to a search warrant. They find the guy is still wearing that 49ers hoodie. He admits to doing the crime. And like, that's the type of thing that happens thousands of times a day, where not only are we actually solving more crime, we're introducing a new level of objectivity because we're focusing on the vehicle and not, in this case, an eyewitness testimony.
Well, so in that case, so the mission is obviously is noble, and yeah, the specific examples are I mean incredible. But as that problem first presented itself, and 7 years ago, your car is gone, the pharmacy gets hit up, car gets abandoned, and all of that, you landed on a something that I don't know. In retrospect, maybe is obvious, like anything is in hindsight. But landed on a specific problem in technology. Yeah. And so maybe can you talk about like the initial, I realize you guys have a plethora of products today, but like the very first thing that you landed on and decided to go after, and describing like what that is and how it works?
Yeah, for sure. So when we started the company, it was just a project, right? Like I called Paige and Matt, two of my closest friends. They had worked for me at my last company. And I said, hey, I think crime is a really interesting problem. And I wonder why people aren't solving it. And I have no background in law enforcement, no background in criminal justice, never owned a gun. Then start calling these police chiefs. And I'm like, hey, why can't you solve crime? Because look, I think a lot of us assume there's some level of apathy as a part of the problem. Like you can go look, these are public salaries. You don't make a lot of money being a cop. Even, you know, I think like, you know, police chiefs are still making $100,000, $150,000, and they're at the peak of their career.
Like, yeah, they're top.
No getting bigger. Yeah,
yeah. My cousin's a cop in Chattanooga, so I know.
Yeah, it's not, you know, it's tough, right? And it's not like they don't have any scrutiny day to day. And so you look at these men and women, you go, okay, maybe it's apathy. But then you talk to them and you go, no, it's not apathy. They're no different than nurses and teachers. They just were born with this strong desire to serve their community. So then you start to go, okay, well, why is it? And you go, okay, it's evidence. Well, why don't you have enough evidence? And they're like, oh, well, it's because it's really expensive. It's like, what do you mean? Well, the evidence we need is a license plate. And I was like, that seems really weird to me. Why would you need a license plate? And they're like, oh, it's the number one piece of evidence in solving a crime. 70%+ of crimes happen with a vehicle. Like, this is what we need. And so I'm looking into it with Paige and Matt, and we're like, oh, but there's vendors that do this, right? Like a camera that can read a license plate is not a new concept. But what we noticed was that there was these two underlying problems with the existing solutions. And it was all centralized on cost. At the time, 7 years ago, the average camera fully deployed was about $50,000 per unit. And so maybe if you're in New York, like you cover your egress points because you're one of the biggest cities in America and like you can afford it. But like, what about Newark? What about Elizabeth? What about like go down to your average city and you're like, no, that's so much money. And the reason why it was so expensive is twofold. One was infrastructure and one was bill of materials. On the infrastructure side, traditional systems required hardline power and hardline internet. And if you've ever built a home, construction's expensive. It's like really expensive to dig holes, really expensive to conduit, power, and fiber, hundreds of feet. And so you've effectively signed up for a construction project. So we said, okay, well, what if we got rid of all the infrastructure? Like, what if it was just a cell phone on a pole? That would then remove that cost. And then the second thing we looked at was said, well, wait a second, why are they using these very proprietary, bespoke DSP chips. I was an electrical engineer. And so we're breaking it down of like, they're using an infrared array with a DSP chip to do a very, very legacy approach to optical character recognition, or OCR. And Matt and I were like, well, why wouldn't you just use computer vision? Like, it can't be that hard. It wound up being harder than we thought, but like, a phone should be able to do this. So we literally got some old Android phones. I tore them apart, soldered together a bigger battery and a solar panel. And Matt, who's like one of the best developers I've ever met, maybe the best developer I've ever met, quickly like put together a computer vision model, an Android app, put it up on my street, and all of a sudden we were reading license plates. Now, in the middle of the summer in Atlanta, an Android phone outside is going to overheat pretty quickly. So like, realized that like, okay, this isn't going to scale, but we've built a, you know, a competitive product that had zero implementation costs and had a bill of materials that was a couple $100. And that felt like really special. And they're like, Peter Thiel saying, we had these two secrets that no one else knew, which was like, we could dramatically deploy more devices at a lower cost, like a 10x better product at a 10th of the price.
The timing of every market's obviously pretty important. And the set of circumstances that led to this opportunity, was there a window of time that 5 years earlier it wouldn't have worked because of the camera technology, OCR, solar, whatever it was, and you guys happened to catch it then? Like, how wide open was the window that Flock could have worked for you know, you guys, or if someone had started it before?
Yeah, I think we got, you know, we got very lucky with timing. I would like to think that we were like super, super thoughtful about it. But the smartphone was key, because the camera technology, you've got people like Apple and Samsung deploying billions of dollars a year into smartphone technology, which is mostly low power devices with really good cameras. And that's effectively what we are. It's like, we're riding the tail of that wave. And then what you also have is this dramatic reduction in cloud compute. And it's weird probably for you and I to think about an environment where on-prem is default. But when you're talking about servicing, you know, our average camera does 30 or 40 gigabytes of data a month. That's a lot of data, not only to push through the internet, but also to store it online. And that is still, like, if you look at the camera market in general, it is still mostly on-prem. And so that evolution, I think, is still happening. Like, we're still actually right. While smartphones are quite, like, there's innovation still happening, but it's mostly moved to AI. Like, we do quite a bit of AI on our imaging platform. The cloud piece is really interesting, because you look at companies like Verkada, and I know you've talked with them, and you look at companies like us, and I mean, if the cloud wasn't getting cheaper by the quarter, by the day, we wouldn't exist.
So as it currently stands, so that was the thesis originally, and the belief around it. Where are you in that journey? How would you describe the product today? It seems like it's solar powered. I had heard something. There's like two different cameras. It's angled at just license plate readers. Yeah. Can you just give like the you know, jumping forward to 2024 and where you are with that?
Yeah. So, if we go back all the way to that vision, I remember during YC, we had a slide, and we only had one slide in our pitch deck, and it was a mugshot. And we said, we built a product that actually solves crime. We don't know who we're going to sell to. We don't know how we're going to sell it. We don't know how we're going to charge. But I fundamentally believe that if you pass that toothbrush test, everyone wants to live in a crime-less society. And we built a product that does that. That is largely still the same case. Now, I think we have figured out who we sell to. We've done a pretty good job figuring that out. We've done a pretty good job building out a business. But if you go to a place like San Francisco, who's recently coming online with Flock, you know, they've got about 400 devices now in the downtown area, that as a car drives by, a few things happen. The first is, we, within a few seconds, read the license plate, and then we have a direct integration with the FBI, and we can check, is that car stolen? Is that car on an Amber Alert? Is it on a Silver Alert? Does it have an outstanding felony warrant? But there's a list of objective things that makes that car either illegal to be on the road or legal to be on the road. And if it's illegal on the road, let's say it's got an Amber Alert or a felony warrant, we immediately notify the nearest officer in their vehicle. So now, within, let's call it 5 to 10 seconds from a car driving by, the nearest officer is notified, hey, this Kia, this white Kia that's stolen is at this location. We don't know who's inside. We don't care who's inside. We know that car's stolen. And that leads to about 2,000 arrests every single day, like that feature. The second thing that happens is when that car does drive by, we also do what's called capture its vehicle fingerprint. That's a list of about 26 different unique attributes of a vehicle that with our computer vision model, we say, okay, it is white. It's a white car. It's a Honda. It's an Accord. It's got a Nevada license plate. It's got a roof rack. It's got bumper stickers. Anything a human would notice on the vehicle, we also tag. And so from a retrospective, so let's say that a crime happened and you didn't know the car was stolen already, and detectives can then go in and say, hey, I'm looking for any white Honda with a Nevada license plate that was here yesterday at 2 o'clock in this area. Show me all the cars. And that tends to be the beginning of a case. We're never the end all be all in a criminal investigation. We're typically the first step of a process that gets the detective on their way.
And you're actually removing the subjectivity of a lot of the inputs, right? Where there's not the same bias. You're not actually even capturing who the driver of the car is purposefully, right? And so it's really just focused on the vehicle itself.
Yeah. I mean, I was shocked at just how important a vehicle could be in a criminal investigation. Like, still kind of confuses me to this day as someone who's been in it for a long time now. It is the beginning of the case, and who's inside is kind of irrelevant until you get a human involved, until a detective takes over the case. And then, yeah, you got to go drive an investigation because you can't arrest a vehicle. But to my earlier point on kind of the eyewitness story, a lot of subjectivity in policing. By design, it's a subjective game. We're trying to put a little bit more objectivity into it.
Can we talk about the nature of crime? I feel like you have some interesting perspectives on nonviolent versus violent crime and what serves as deterrents of different types of crime in a modern society, and how incentives and punishments actually kind of play a role or lack thereof in different circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a country, we've unfortunately made a decision historically that crime is okay. And there are some people who live in this country that are generally fine with crime. They think crime is just a cost of doing business. Crime is a mandated requirement of living in a big city or in a modern society. And I just deeply disagree with that sentiment. That's like almost saying that like poverty is a requirement. I don't think so. Actually, I think the quality of life has gone up decade over decade. And it will continue to go up, hopefully. And like some of these big issues we face as a country, I think are actually quite solvable. Now, I think, you know, it's unlikely that a technology company alone can solve these things. And that's kind of our point of view. Our point of view is that it's a combination of people, policy, and technology. Like I mentioned the story earlier of what Mayor Dickens is doing on the youth side. That's policy. Right, like he's trying to stop kids from even thinking about becoming criminals, giving them jobs. That's awesome. That's a policy thing. That's a people thing. And then where technology comes in is that if you look at the underlying reason why people do commit crime, it's a Boolean decision, right? Your average criminal is a 16 to 22-year-old male. And there's a reason why they won't let you rent a car until you're over 22. It's because your brain isn't fully developed. You tend to make Boolean decisions. As an adult now, you and I make a calculus decision. We think about the probability of something happening that weighs our decision framework, and then we make a yes or no decision eventually. As an adolescent, it's yes or no. And if you believe you can get away with something, you do it. And so what we believe is that in cities that have deployed Flock, they are starting to change that calculus to say, hey, actually, clearance rates have gone from 13% to 30%. To 50% to 80%. And we've got some cities that are at 100% clearance rate, which means if you live in that city, you know, if I commit this crime, I will get held accountable. And guess what? Crime goes down. It's a very, very simple concept. But it actually is working. Whereas clearance rates go up, crime rates goes down, because the majority of crime, right? You remove the 0.001% of people that are just truly evil, which we're not trying to get rid of. We're not trying to fix that. We're trying to fix the 99.99% of crime that is simply opportunistic, that can be solved by driving clearance rates up.
In the punishment side of things, like, hey, if I break into a car, I get 10 years in prison versus 10 months versus probation. I guess there's been different studies that I'm not appropriately educated on, but I'm sure you've seen some of the data that the nature of the punitiveness of the crime actually doesn't serve as much as a deterrent versus the just simply getting caught.
There's zero academic studies that have proven any correlation between the severity of penalty and the impact on crime.
Now, I guess back to your Boolean point, it's not a probabilistic calculation.
Like, I'm not going to get. I mean, you think about it, right? Like, you probably took statistics in college. If you know the average is a 13% chance of getting caught, like everyone, you assume you're above average, right? Because why would I be below average at anything I do? And as a 16-year-old, you definitely thought you were above average at everything you did, invincible. Yep. So you're like, well, I'm not getting caught. He might get caught, but I won't get caught. And you're not thinking about punishment because you don't assume you're going to get caught. Now, I am sure there is a trailing point where it's like, well, if there's no punishment, well, then clearly that's probably not enough. But the difference between a month, 6 months, a year in jail just doesn't matter. What matters is people believe that we have created a society that upholds the rules we've all agreed to. Because, like, one of the interesting dynamics, and this is actually a beautiful part about our country we live in, the rules are not evenly enforced. And I actually think that's, like, quite good. Because the rules in Georgia, the rules in Atlanta, even though we have the similar federal laws and our state laws are a little bit different, we as a society, as a community, choose what's socially enforced.
So Flock goes into a city. I realize there's a split between selling to homeowners associations and so kind of private citizens, and increasingly you're selling into state, local government. As well, but can you I guess a commercial for the efficacy of what you're doing, can you give some stats around like the delta and clearance rate of maybe some city that you went in, and how many cameras were installed and what that did to you know the efficacy of solving crime?
Yeah I mean literally when we roll out with a city, if they don't make an arrest within their first hour of deployment, something's wrong. We either haven't properly trained them, the cameras are somehow in like the wrong place or not working. Like I don't know of a single customer we've rolled out that hasn't solved a crime within their first hour. When you look longer term, you know, I think about a place like Cobb County, which was one of our first customers, and you go to the chief there and he will tell you that they have back-to-back years with 100% clearance rate on violent crime. And if it wasn't for Flock, that wouldn't be the case. And then you go on public record and say this. And I think it's true. And I think, you know, obviously, just like with a lot of things, it is hard to drive very, very hard science on efficacy. I think what we look for is, you know, what percentage of crimes are being solved using the product. We're at about 10% nationally. But the impact is pretty demonstrable overnight.
Can you speak to a specific example? And I know there's tons of them, but just to really make it concrete of a situation that, and maybe how it played out, and case study maybe sounds too business oriented, but a situation that really makes this tangible of X person did Y thing and Flock was able to solve it. Just one that sort of stayed with you as, you know, something you're particularly proud of.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. There's probably two moments, if you'll give me the chance to share two of them.
Yeah. We got time.
The first one, and this is like the company might've been 6 months old, maybe. And we had deployed the cameras in my neighborhood. And this single woman's home was broken into and all of her stuff was stolen. She wasn't at home. And if you talk to this woman, you know, the stuff is, it's a bummer to lose your stuff, right? But she has a job, she has insurance. The issue was this sense of violation. Like her safety had been violated. It's like deep fear now. And within about an hour of her calling the police, an arrest was made because she did have a camera at her house. And so she had the vehicle description. They were able to plug that into Flock. They then had to make a model and a license plate. And then pretty quickly, they were able to then find that vehicle and make an arrest. And it was important for two reasons. One from personal level, one from business level. From personal level, I talked to this woman and there was this like glimmer of hope, right? And maybe one of the worst days in her life, we were able to provide just a little bit of peace of mind, a little bit of like, no, society is just, the world is just, like, you're going to be protected. And that's like, I get goosebumps to this day thinking about like, that's still happening all the time. I'm not as aware of it because I don't get the chance to talk to all of our customers or our end customers. But like that was, I remember Paige saying like, man, I could spend the rest of my life doing this. Like if this is the impact we make on people's lives every day, like, and we're going to get paid to do this and get paid well, like this is crazy. So that one was like one of the first times on a personal level. On the business level, it was also the first time we realized that every day at 5 o'clock, the news is going to want to talk about crime. They're going to talk about politics. They're going to talk about sports. They're going to talk about crime. And it was the first time we were ever on TV. And it's kind of realized like what was one of the first kind of go-to-market hacks we realized was that PR could be a really big growth channel. I've yet to meet another company that leveraged PR like we did. Most people talk about like, oh, PR is a great strategy. Like, no. PR was our only growth engine for the first 2 or 3 years of the business. Because what we realized is that every single time a crime happens, news wants to cover it. And so like I went on TV and it was this really fun experience being on like local news. So that was the first one. I'd say the most impactful one is I'm a father of 2 young kids. And anytime we help parents with their kids, it's particularly touches home. And most of our employees, I think our average age of employees is in their mid-40s. And so most of us have families with kids, you know, whether it's elementary school or junior high. And thankfully, most child abductions are not strangers. Like if you look at we work really closely with the National Center of Endangered and Missing Children. It's one of our like strongest partnerships. Most abductions are an estranged parent. And so it's scary, but it's very solvable. Like you can solve it within a day. Stranger to stranger abductions are not only really rare, they're really hard to solve. And there's a town that we work with, and it's predominantly an immigrant kind of community. It's a large percent of the population is immigrants. And due to that, they tend to be targeted for crime because the assumption is like, if you steal from these people, they won't call the police, which is like really like multiple levels of ickiness. Because like not only are you committing a crime against someone, you're doing it against a community that you believe like is less safe. And so this woman is walking her child, car pulls up, jumps out, steal the 2-year-old boy out of the stroller. Total stranger. Mom is panicking. She calls 911. All she has is that it's a white SUV. Now this community was one of our better customers at the time, still a great customer. They plug it in the system. Now one of the cool things about Flock is that it is a network, right? So when you think about the why we called it Flock, it's because we believe that as a community, if we work together, we're safer. And that extends not only out of my neighborhood, out of my city, but the cities around me, because criminals don't tend to care where like cities start and stop. Yeah. And so like I doubt you even think about it as like a normal person of like, oh, am I in New York right now? Or am I in a different neighborhood or different city? And so they plug it into Flock, they find the license plate, and they realize the car has now gone on the highway. It's a huge, this is like really bad now. Because once you get on the highway, it's very hard to know where you're going. They then plug it into Flock, and that creates a statewide hot list looking for this vehicle. We get a hit about 45 miles away. That notifies that police department and notifies the GBI, which is like our local version of the FBI. I have one in New York and California. And they safely return the kid. And this is like all in 3 hours. There's like half a dozen police departments involved. And this kid's, I guess, like 5 or 6 now. And we met up, one of our employees met up with the family recently. And like the mom is still so thankful. And sadly, like that kind of stuff does happen every single day. Thankfully, not every single day in my town or your town. But like you look at those kind of stories and I often just reflect, like, I don't know if I'll ever get to work on a company like this again.
Yeah, it's hugely impactful, and I'm sure super gratifying to have even one situation like that you had a role in solving, let alone the thousands a day or whatever it is that you guys contribute to. I guess to talk about the trade, like anything in any decision we make, there's two sides of a coin.
Yeah.
Trade offs around this, and I think I'd be remiss not to ask about the axis or the spectrum of safety and privacy. And like implicitly, we're making decisions on a daily basis that are on one end of the spectrum over the other. And there's countries like China we're giving up a lot of privacy in exchange for safety, and I don't particularly want to live in that society, but you know, it's one that seems to be pretty effective in deterring crime. Then on the other end of the spectrum, there's definitely some wildernesses that we can go live in that have no rules and no laws and all of that. And so I guess, how do you think about data has become so in privacy increasingly with, the things around Facebook and app tracking transparency and GDPR and all these different things.
Yeah.
We're sort of living in this world where there's a continuum and people have different perspectives around it. And so I guess, how do you think about that and where you fall and your responsibility within it?
No, it's a good question. And I think there's probably two sides to it. There's one, we make our own decisions as a company for what we want to build and what we want to enable. And so a good example of that is, you know, we don't do facial recognition. I don't think it's inherently evil. I think it's an effective product. We just choose not to build it, which is a decision we've made as a company. And then I think the other thing that's really important is we live in a society that individuals are elected democratically to make decisions on our behalf. And that covers things like roads and sewage and parks and public safety. And we don't do anything without the support of the community. And so I look at it and go, let's talk about something that's really easy, data retention. I think it's a subjective decision. And so you go to places like Dallas, Texas, and they have a 90-day storage period. And you go to a place like Austin, Texas, and it's 7 days. I don't care. If that's what Austin thinks is best for their community, that's great. That's exciting. So we believe it's our job to give communities the kind of levers to make those decisions. Because to be very clear, Austin will solve less crime than Dallas. It's just a fact. But they're making that trade-off. I'm not making that trade-off for them. The city council and the police chief, they sat down and the city manager and said, hey, we think 7 days is right for us. Dallas said 90. In New Jersey, it's 5 years. I don't live in any of those places, so on a personal level, I don't think it matters. As a business, though, we look at it across the spectrum and say, what are the things we can do to provide our customers the ability to customize what they're doing so it makes sense for their community?
I mean, I guess police aren't elected officials, but they are those that we trust through the process of whatever, democratic elections, and then the people that end up hiring them. What about on the HOA or on the private citizen side? And maybe talk a little bit about, like, I guess as it relates both to HOA and police officers, the access and rights and all of those things and how you think about it.
Yeah. So the cool part is the way we built the product is that most of our neighborhoods don't even have access to the cameras they buy. It goes straight to the police department because you and I don't have the right to arrest someone. We don't have the right to do a criminal investigation, nor would I would imagine you want to. I don't have to do that.
Yeah,
there's a crime in my neighborhood. I got a family. I got a business. So the way the product's built is, like, if you look at my neighborhood, the cameras go straight to the Atlanta Police Department, and not a single person that lives in our community has access to the cameras. Because what would you do with it? And that's like the default. Now, in an environment where either there's an off-duty police officer, a security team, or there's just an HOA that wants to have access, that's fine. They're the ones paying for it. But what we really emphasize is, coming back to the name of the company, like, your job is to support the community, deploy this product, it goes straight to law enforcement. They will use it when they need to, but otherwise, just be on your merry way. And that, I think, is like a really nice kind of model, because then it solves a lot of the privacy concerns, I think, that exist.
I'm sure you get criticism that is not totally rooted in sensible logic, and you know, maybe yes, just FUD and hey, this seems bad, and I don't know. I can imagine the types of people that might claim these things, but outside of those that are maybe less within the bounds of reasonable conversation,
yeah,
are there particular discussions that you welcome having about these different trade-offs, and like where the lines of consideration exist? And I assume data retention sounds like one of them, maybe, and who has access is another, but are there other things that you think are actually worthwhile philosophical debates to have about like your role in society?
Yeah. So I think the cool thing about Flock is, whether you're blue, red, or purple, you have Flock. Like we've got Berkeley, California, and we've got Southern Texas right down on the border. Like, it's like as red as you can get and as blue as you can get. And then we go to New York, we go to Maine, we go to Oregon, Washington. Like, there isn't a state that doesn't have Flock at some level. And I think it's because when you remove the politics of it, everyone wants to be safe. Like, I've never met someone who's like, oh, I would like to be less safe. That's like, it's a very odd feeling. So then to your point, it's like a question of, okay, well, how safe do we want to be? Because in some environment, I don't know if you saw the news, like I think Miami during spring break had a midnight curfew or like 11 p.m. curfew. That's safer. It, like, bad stuff happens at 2 a.m. Like, nothing good happens in the middle of the night. And so like Miami made a decision on their own accord that like, hey, during spring break, we just want to be a little bit safer. Now, I don't think Miami is going to do that forever, because it's fun to stay out late. And so you look at those kind of decisions, and like, we're one of those types of decisions where you could say, look, you know, if we want to be safer, there's this product called Flock that will solve more crime. Do we want it as a community? And I think last year, you know, I think 3 out of about 1,000 cities said, no, we don't want Flock. And we're okay. It's like, okay, great. No hard feelings. Like, you know, call us if you change your mind.
And who is it saying no? I guess I don't know enough about local governments. City council.
So, I mean, so, and it's, I think it's great. Like, the chief of police will present an option. It's his job or her job to keep the community safe. And they'll present us as an option. And in 3 cases, I think last year, a city said, hey, you know, we just don't think it's right for us. And we go, that's great. You know, like, that's no hard feelings. I hope they change their mind. To your point, a lot of the time it is misinformation. So as an example, one of those three, last year, originally said no, because they thought we were doing facial recognition on the cameras. And we were like, we don't do facial recognition on the cameras. And they voted that way because, look, it's, you know, most of these people are volunteers. It's not a full-time job. You don't get paid to be on city council in a small town. In a bigger city, you do, and it's a little bit manageable. But in a small town, you don't get paid. So these are volunteers trying to make the best decisions they can. So they did eventually come back around, because we were able to educate them of like, no, we don't do facial recognition, that like these are very focused on cars and that's how the technology works. So most of the time it is either the fear of the unknown or just misinformation. Like they don't fully understand the technology. I do think though, to your point, there's data retention. That's an interesting one. And then the other one is data sharing. You know, who do you want to share with? Most of our cities work really closely with their neighboring cities. So if you're in the Bay Area and you're in, you know, Atherton, you work with Cupertino and Redwood City and Foster City and like San Mateo, because you're solving cases together all the time anyways. But it is up to a city. Like, we have one customer that I know of in Illinois that does not share with anyone. And that as a city, they decided they want to keep this information just to themselves. And that's fine. I think that they will solve less crime. But that's important to them. And I think that's great. And so we're always trying to figure out, the same point of view would be on the overall auditing and transparency. So everything you do in the system is fully audited and stored in perpetuity. Some of our customers share that audit publicly. It's great. So in Piedmont, California, great police department there. The camera locations, the search history, it's like a ton of information publicly available. We built that form. We call it our transparency portal. It's great. Other of our customers say, it's not for us. We don't want to do that. Okay. So we're always trying to figure out, like, how do we help our customers achieve their goal, which is solve more crime, be safe, in a framing that makes the most sense for their own community's kind of other goals.
You know, I don't think it's particularly controversial to say that the job of a police officer should be a noble one in the society that we live in, or in a modern and sophisticated society. But there's been some circumstances over the course of the last couple of years that have drawn attention, and I'm sure it's been going on. I know it's been going on far longer than just the last couple of years. We just happen to have technology to capture it and document it in ways that have illuminated some of the some bad actors within police departments, or unfortunate set of circumstances that have led to loss of life and just you know, terrible circumstances, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I think just like in every industry, you know, there's something like, you know, a million police officers in America. You put a million people in a room, there's going to be some bad people.
Yes, and I think we've these are people that are entrusted to try to bring stability to society, and I think it's particularly troubling when it's not accountants committing fraud, or, you know, shitty podcasters or whatever it is. Like, it's particularly troubling when it's the people that we trust with great power within society. But I think it's a lot of the rhetoric has led to a disproportionate number of resignations, early retirement, lack of enrollment into the service. Can you just talk about maybe some of the broad trends that are going on in policing today, and then what role you feel like Flock can play in this?
Yeah. So it is a challenging time. More than 80% of police departments are understaffed. And that's not like, the police chief saying, I want more people. That's the government, the city, the local government has given them budget for X number of people, and they're at Y. And in this case, Y is less than X. So the majority of police departments are understaffed. And that is a new problem. That was not a problem 10 years ago. That's a problem that's happened over the last 3 years. Now, COVID was particularly bad. Like, that was not good. And then the social unrest was not good. I don't know if it's ever going to get better. I would equate it similar to probably the problem we have with teachers. Like, I don't know how we're going to get more teachers. Teach for America was pretty interesting. Maybe one of the best ideas I've heard is, like, why don't we have a Teach for America for policing? Like, that's an interesting idea. That's like one I've heard. I think what Mayor Bibb has done in Cleveland is pretty interesting. What he did was said, look, you know, we've got staffing for 1,000 officers. We only have 800. We have no line of sight to get back to 1,000. I'm actually going to decrease the headcount allocation down to 800. And that extra budget, I'm just going to raise everyone's wage. That helps with enrollment, you know, like, it also helps with retention. You give everyone a 20% raise and like, oh man, you know, I will put in a couple more years. So it is a pretty big problem, because there's pretty consistent data that shows a lack of a law enforcement agency just leads to unrest. And if you look at the cities, and the number of cities that did this was very small, a lot of cities talked about defunding the police. Only two or three cities across the entire country actually did it. And they have had a massive spike in crime. they're in a massive hole now in terms of recruiting and running people through the academy. And it's going to take them another 5 or 7 years to actually get out of it and just get back to where they were. So I think most cities realized, you know, reform is always necessary. It's good, right? Like, the best example is I've never met a cop that wants to respond to non-law enforcement related activity. They still get asked to. Like, if there's an individual with a mental health issue and you send a law enforcement officer that has zero training, I don't know what we expect. Like, to go perfect? No, they're going to like really struggle with that when they're actually people who have been trained to deal with mental health. And so you do see cities, I think, are moving in the right direction saying, hey, we've got to increase the number of first responders we have. We have fire as a first responder. We have law enforcement responder. We need a medical team. Like, we actually need more types, more diversity. That's expensive, right? But like, I don't know how else to fix that. So it is a troubling problem. I would say the only thing that I think is the silver lining amongst all this is technology is becoming more available. I think one of the benefits that Flock has brought to the market is not only are we a force multiplier, like you can get more done as a police department because you're not, you know, the traditional view of policing is you drive around the neighborhoods, you know, there are problems looking for suspicious activity. One, that's incredibly wasteful. And two, it's incredibly subjective because you wind up going after the same people in our audience. It's like double bad. With Flock, you talk to most of our customers and they'll say, we're too busy chasing stolen cars to do that kind of stuff anymore. So driven up productivity and driven up objectivity. From a more venture perspective, though, we have proven that you can build a venture business selling to local government. And like one of the things that I love now is, at least once a week, I'm getting a pitch deck from an early stage company that's trying to go after local government. And I think that's awesome. Like, it is a market that's so underserved. Now, you know, competitive a little bit. Like, all right, well, I want to build a really, really big business. So like, you know, I'm always looking out for like, what are the more interesting ones happening? But if you go back 7 years ago before Flock, we got no after no after no from investors because they would say like, oh, local government is not a venture backable market. The last IPO that serviced local government was in 2003. It was the last IPO. You know, you've got one of your peers in Andreessen Horowitz, who's an investor in Flock with their American Dynamism Fund. And you see more investors like y'all saying, wait a second, actually, like some of these more industrial markets, you look at companies like Samsara leading the way as well of saying like, actually vertical SaaS can be really effective. It's hard. It's really hard. But when it gets right, like you've got incredible GRR, you've got bigger TAMs than you ever imagined because you see this evolution, and we're seeing it in policing now where budget is shifting from headcount to technology. And so the first time this ever happened to us was in Katy, Texas, I think. And the police chief went to city council and said, look, I have a headcount problem and I have no plan to fix it. I do not have an answer, but I do have this thing called technology. And the fully loaded cost, when you include pension and benefits, it's about $150,000 a year for an entry-level officer. That's the same cost of 50 cameras. Now, I can't get rid of all of my police officers, and we know that'd be a horrible idea. But man, to take two officers off of headcount, which I can't even fill anyways, and go get 100 cameras that'll impact our entire police department, like that's such an obvious ROI. And so I'm seeing more and more of these police chiefs and the newer command staff saying, we got to find the right balance. Got to find the right balance of sworn versus unsworn, technology versus headcount. There's a balance there to be had. And I think that's like really, really exciting to watch.
So what's next for Flock? So we talked about license plate readers, which I think is still the majority of the revenue and, yep, you know, a big component of solving crime for you all. I've seen now there's a product called Raven as well that you guys have launched around gunshot detection. Can you talk through like the suite that you have today and the aspirations of where you're going to go?
Yeah. So I'll start with the aspirations and come back to what we do today. Every quarter, the team looks at all the crimes that happen in America and try to draw a direct line to a product we've built to help solve them. And there's a lot of crimes we help with. So you mentioned our core product, Falcon, reading license plates. That solves a lot of crimes. You know, entering auto, residential burglaries, a bunch of that. we never had a product that helped solve violent crime, you know, particularly gun related. So we developed Raven, which is our gunshot detection technology, which solves gun violence every single day, which is a sad reality of our society, but it is a reality. And so we built this product to go help solve it. And there are cases, you know, whether you go to a Wichita, Kansas, or an Albany, Georgia, where they're shocked at the level of gun violence they had because no one calls 911 when someone gets shot. And so that's been really interesting to watch. We have developed a new product called FlockOS 911. It's really cool. One of the things I didn't realize is that if you call 911 today, until you effectively finish the phone call, it's not entered into what's called CAD or computer aided dispatch. And no one on the first responder side has any idea you're having a problem. You could have an officer like a block away from you. You've got a 2 to 5 minute lag before them even being notified. And so FlockOS 911 allows us to co-listen, kind of like dial into a bridge of the 911 call and send that directly to the nearest officer. So now if you called 911, we find the nearest officer. And if they're within a relative distance, right? So if it's Manhattan, that might be like a block, 2 blocks, because traffic is really bad. If you're in a more suburban town, that might be 1 mile or 3 miles. But if you're in that radius, we will ping the nearest officer and say, hey, there's an active 911 call happening right now. Click play. They can click play. They can listen to the call. They can make a judgment call of like, is this appropriate for me to start to dispatch? And if it is, what we're seeing is that response times are going down dramatically, often beating the call from hanging up. And that's like the dream state. Or dream state is that if you call 911 before you even hang up, an officer is on site. I think that will dramatically change how officers dispatch. And to our earlier conversation on human capital, when we're in a shortage of humans, this is a way to actually increase their effectiveness. We can get them going before things get started. So we have like a whole slew of products like that where we're looking for these kind of pinpointed problems of what's happening in this town, what's happening in that town, how do we help them solve more of their crimes? And like one of the favorite things that I get to do is I travel the country and I'll sit down with a mayor and a police chief and say, hey, tell me about a crime that didn't get solved. Pull up one of your cold cases. Let's like work through that. And that kind of becomes our roadmap for what products to go build.
And so today the suites that you sell, like the incremental things,
So we've got a camera focused on cars.
Yep.
We have a camera that's focused on intersections, kind of like live view camera. So if you take someone like Fresno, they've bought almost our entire suite. It's pretty awesome. They have our LPRs, so you can track cars. License plate reader. They have our product called Condor, which is for situational awareness. So they deploy those at intersections, right? So they want to know what's happening in an intersection and click play and pull it right up. They have Raven, which is our gunshot detection technology. And then they have FlockOS, which is really our kind of situational awareness platform. And that allows them to go into the community and say, hey, if you're a business owner, a homeowner, you can subscribe and we can now have access to your cameras. And what that means is in a single pane of glass, Fresno can pull up and say, hey, there's a 911 call happening right now. And this local community, this local business owner, whether it's a strip mall or a gas station, they've allowed us to integrate with their cameras. We can now pull that up. And it's like this dramatic increase of productivity and deeper engagement with the community. So we got that product and then a whole bunch of stuff coming down the line too.
That's cool. What if you're painting a utopian version of the future for Flock and the impact on society, is there any what would be the most concrete kind of utopian vision for where you want to go in the coming decade?
Yeah, so my kids are starting kindergarten. So I got like 10 years until they're in high school. I'd say my goal is that by the time they're in high school, crime is largely not a problem anymore in America. We're not going to be able to get rid of evil people, right? Let me clarify, right? There's still going to be evil people. But if you talk about, you know, will I feel good that my 15 or 16 year old daughter is driving in Atlanta? Will I feel like she's safe all the time? I think if we solve that problem, like that's what we're out to do. And I think we'll do it. Like, the cool thing is that it is happening in small pockets of the country. And it's just a question of, I guess it's the is it Mark Andreessen who said, you know, the future is ready here. It's just unevenly distributed.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's the case for us too, where we see these pockets where crime is largely a thing of the past. And I imagine that world where you just don't talk about crime anymore. And I know it's quite hard for people to imagine, but I guess I would equate it to, you know, the idea of having like one drink and driving used to be pretty normal, right? Like taxis were kind of complicated, you know, black cars were way too expensive. So you have like one drink at dinner and then drive home. Now it's like, why would you do that? Like,
yeah.
Ride sharing has completely changed the way we move around cities. And Uber's not even that old of a company. And like fundamentally changed transportation. And I look at public safety and like that just hasn't happened. And I think we're the ones who are going to be able to do it.
It's exciting. I want to transition a little bit to operating and some of the beliefs you have around running a business. So there's always a balance between a market and a team in starting a company. And it sounds like you've much more gravitated, while your market opportunity is as compelling as it is, you've gravitated more to the people side of things. Can you talk about how you think about the trade-off between those two and an idea and market centric versus people and that side?
Yeah, I am a staunch believer in that people trumps product trumps market. I think great teams build great products and find great markets. I don't know any other way to do it. I don't know. It's kind of really hard to imagine how you'd start otherwise. And so I've just always believed if you have a great team, the rest comes with that. In the absence of a great team, I think it's really hard. And I look at Flock as a great example. If you look at that, the original kind of pitch, our seed and our Series A, there was nothing about local government. We were 100% focused on neighborhoods. And we've now realized that local government's a really good market, but it's because we had a great team. Like the team found that market.
Mm.
And so like for me, at least, I've had the same team three companies in a row. And Flock is by multiple orders of magnitude the biggest business we've built. And I think it's just we have a really good team that works really well together. We built three really good businesses together. This is the biggest because we happen to get the best market. But like absent that team, I don't know. I think it's so hard to get the team right. And I think also, this might be a Southern perspective. I just think like one of the best parts about being an entrepreneur is you get to pick who you work with. If I didn't want to have to get to pick who I work with, I'd go work at someone else's company. And so like, why would you not focus on a team when that's one of the only things you actually can control? And I would go sell, you know, water to the ocean with the right people. Like, I don't know. I just find the market and the product to be less interesting than like who I spend my life with.
Yeah. You know? Interesting. One of the things we talked about before we hopped on is you all have a unique approach to hiring and the onboarding process where there's kind of a two-way pip or there's expectations set up around a job spec and what the job to be done is. Can you talk through that method of how you make that work?
Yeah, I will go on the record saying I hate the idea of job descriptions. I think there's just... they're really dumb because they're creating this like artificial layer between what we're going to ask you to go do. It's like, you need 7 years of product marketing experience. It's like, why is that relevant? Why is that relevant at all? And it's like, oh, you will own is this like bland. It's like such fluff. When the fact of the matter is like at Flock, at least we only open a role if the person's going to make an immediate, measurable impact to the business within their 90 days. And if they're not going to do that, then it's not a job. You're just adding a body to a problem, potentially. It's like, I just believe very deeply, there's a saying, Michael Siebel at YC said this during our batch, like, the fastest your company will ever run is during this batch. So set the velocity as high as possible and hold on to dear life that you can maintain it. And I think people are the same. And so like, I have this strong belief that if you come out of the gate slow, you will never speed up. I've never met an individual that like picks up pace at like, oh, their third year of being a Flock, they're now operating at max capacity. I'm like, no, like their first week is going to tell me exactly how they're going to operate. And so what we tend to do is put together a very, very actionable 90-day plan for every new employee. It's during the interview process. So literally the beginning of every quarter when we do budgeting, my co-founder Paige and I review every single 90-day plan, and that's how we decide what roles actually get opened. I trust my CFO James to keep us honest on like budget, but Paige and I look at like, are people actually going to make an impact? Is the plan actionable? And what that does is it drives this deep level of alignment between a new employee and their manager, because you're effectively telling them, this is how I'm going to keep score as your manager. And like, so few jobs actually give that to you. Most jobs are like, oh, I mean, maybe in your line of work, it's like quite easy, which is like invest in good companies. You still have like a 5-year delay on whether or not you made a good decision.
It's actually quite hard because there's so many different people that do it very differently. And so there's no like pattern matching that you can do of how to practice the craft, right?
No. And so like for us, we just say, look, we're a very unique culture. We expect people to come out of the gate very fast. We expect people to make an impact within their first 30 days. And at the end of 90 days, if you're not like super happy and want to still be here, you should just leave, because this will never show up on your resume. No one will look down upon it. And like, you're in and out. There's like very little loss. And as a hiring manager, you're also going like, if you can't make an impact at this company within your first 90 days, there's zero reason to believe you ever will. And that's okay. Like, let's do this now. Let's not wait. And so I view it as a two-way thing. Because I think there are a lot of great companies. We run ours very specifically, and it's not for everyone, and that's okay. But we found it to be really effective. It's like an awesome tool. It also is just we've now noticed, as we've got employees getting to their third, fourth, fifth year at the company, that we use that same tool pretty often. So now it's like, if you have a new manager, you have to have a 90-day plan. If you have a new responsibility in the company, you get a new 90-day plan. If you just feel like you're lacking alignment with your manager, like as an employee, you can tell your manager, like, I want a 90-day plan. Like, I want to know how you're tracking my success. And we see like our best people tend to ask for it the most, because those people want to be on the steepest career trajectory. And the easiest way to get more responsibility is like, tell me how you're keeping score, because I want to go one step above it. Like, if that's what you think success is, then like, great, I'm going to add 4 more bullets and go do these too. And it's been a really, really impactful tool.
Your mission is such that I assume it draws people that are in particular feel motivated and empowered to help solve crime and believe in what you guys are doing. I think one of the tensions that ultimately exists when you have a very mission-driven company is that people are going to be on different lines of the spectrum when it comes to different considerations and debates and things like that. And it's not always going to be consistent, and people are going to view it as something more than just a job. It's viewed as, you know, some level of total fulfillment, because they're there for something beyond just the ability to make money. I guess one, do you agree with that? And two, when those situations present themselves, like, how do you lead to resolution when a lot of these things maybe are opaque, or there's often two sides of the coin that both could be true, but you need to ultimately come up with one side?
Yeah, we do this thing, Paige and I do this thing every Friday for new employees. We call like our cultural norms. We walk through in more detail, like how you're expected to behave. And one of the topics is mission versus profit. Because a lot of our employees, I'd say the majority of them, would work for free at Flock, maybe not forever, but as long as they could, because they didn't necessarily have the desire to carry a gun and a badge, but they had a desire to impact their community. And most of our employees are at a career point where they've had a lot of success. They've kind of hit a point and they're now looking for more. Like, they want more than just compensation. They want fulfillment in their career. And we give that to people. But it creates this challenge, right? Because we're not a nonprofit. To be very clear, every one of our employees has equity in the business. They're owners, and like, businesses generally are measured by some discounted cash flow. So like, we got to make money. And what we try to remind people, what I try to remind people is like, if you look at the history of companies, the biggest companies actually tend to be the ones that have the biggest impact on the world. And you look at someone like Apple, and it was a good company, but it has reached $1 trillion status because of the iPhone, which makes sense. The iPhone has like changed the world. You look at Google, and it's like, literally as a verb, like it should be a massive company. It's changed the way we access information. And so the point I try to make to the team is like, the worst thing we could actually do is go out of business. If we don't charge our customers, if we don't make money, we will go out of business. And that could be, that is the worst thing. So we try to find that balance of like, you know, the best thing we can do is succeed, solve crime, make money, build a big business. But I do think that business model aside, let's assume we fast forward 10 years from now and crime is largely gone and it's because of us. It's like hard to imagine a world where we're not a $100+ billion company. That's at least my belief. I hope that comes true. But I just think those two are actually like pretty correlated. And you don't have to give one without the other.
You're a self-professed micromanager, I don't know if that's the term you would use, but very in the details of things. How do you think about that as part of your job versus the other thing of, autonomy, empowerment, all whatever the other side of that coin would be in your responsibility as CEO?
Yeah, I do think, and this might be a Southern thing or a Georgia thing. Like everyone in the company eventually reports to me. And so this newer concept that I shouldn't care about every detail of what you do is really weird to me, because like, it is my job to care about what you're doing. It is my job to give you direction. It is my job to sweat the details. And it's like it just is weird to me that not every CEO and every employee or person like gets that. Because like, we're not a democracy at Flock. It's a pyramid. Like I sit at the top, which means I'm also ultimately responsible. Like every quarter, my board sits around the table and says, "Is Garrett still the best CEO to run this company?" So they sit above me, and at some point they might decide I'm not, and then I'm out. And I guess the way I look at it is, I think about my job in three functions. Some days I'm my direct reports manager and I'm deep in their stuff. And I want to get into every single detail, and it makes people very uncomfortable. But people assume falsely that it is a trust issue. Like, oh, I don't trust you, so I want to micromanage you. It's like, no, I actually want to help you be successful. And in an environment that at least I'm in now, and in a company that's about 1,000 people fully distributed, I don't know how else to make good decisions without access to the primary raw data. And that looks like micromanaging, but it's really like, I don't know how else to make good decisions. Second part of my job is to be a peer, right? So it's like, how are we making decisions together? And then the third job I actually view is like, how do I work for you? And so if you think about like our CRO, I'm on the road every single week visiting with customers on our biggest deals. I'm working for him to help him hit his number. Now, when I'm also there, I'm assessing what's the quality of our demos? What's the quality of the relationships we have with these prospects? Like, how are we progressing this deal? And so I guess for me, like, I expect my team to do the exact same thing. And I just don't believe that the right management approach is to hire smart people and let them run. I think that's crazy. Because like, how will they know where to run? Like, it's your job as a manager to force that alignment. And I think one of my board members once described it as, it often feels like you have the eye of Sauron, you know, from like the Lord of the Rings. Because it seems like wherever we put our energy behind, things get better. And at least that's what I've noticed, is the places I tend to direct my energy tend to get better a lot faster. And so, you know, on a quarterly basis, monthly basis, that energy tends to shift. And people get a little bit uncomfortable, but people come out of the other end of it quite happy, because they got the force of the company behind them. Because if it's truly a problem, it's unlikely a performance issue. It's most likely a lack of resourcing. Like, we have this one problem in the company today, and it's like, it was kind of on the side, wasn't a big deal. Started seeing customer data come back that our customers really frustrated. And I dig in and I'm like, this is just a staffing issue. Like, I think we're literally understaffed by 3x. Like, we didn't design this right. And then was able to immediately open up budget to go triple the team. And so the person was like really uncomfortable for about a month, because she was like, man, Garrett's like really digging into this topic, and like, I'm not used to this level of scrutiny. But then you walk out of it and it's like, no, I think you're doing a great job. She don't think you have enough people. Let's go hire 12 more people like now. Now she's super excited. So I don't know. I guess for me, I've just always been a person that just loves to be in the details and loves to see raw progress and work in progress. And I hate this idea that as a CEO, like, I only get delivered polished goods. It's just like, that's boring. I don't know. Like, I don't want to just sit here and get presentations all day of like how good we're doing and all the things that are going well. But it's like, I don't know. I don't work at a company that's 100 years old that's generating lots of cash flow. Like, I work at a company that's growing like a weed where we have only problems. It's like, I just want to go solve those problems.
Speaking of growing like a weed, so you said you're roughly 1,000 people today. Is that right?
Yeah, about 1,000 people. Yeah.
And what were you, I don't know, 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
Probably 300 or 400.
300 or 400. Okay.
So we doubled headcount year over year for a while, and I think we grew headcount by about 40% last year. So
doubling headcount year over year, means that you're counting some attrition. Then that means that usually when you look around a room, half or more than half of the people have been there for less than 12 months, right? So how do you think about the balance, or how have you been able to balance scaling a team as fast as you have while making sure people are aligned and, you know, keeping a culture that is consistent across an organization when so many of the bodies are new at any given time?
Yeah. I don't know if we do it well. I think we're definitely trying. A few things that have worked well, though, I mentioned this briefly, but I'll come back to it. Every new employee gets 2 touch points with Paige and myself in their first month. And the first one is just like a wide open, just like, let's just have a coffee chat. You know, it's on Zoom, which is not ideal. And like that's really helpful. The more helpful one, though, is about 4 years ago when the business was really starting to scale, I got this advice from Ben Horowitz that, like, if you don't write your culture down, it is inherently weak. In the absence of like a written culture, your culture will just fade away. And in a remote environment, even harder, right? Because like, you don't see these people, you don't interact with these people. And so Paige and I looked around the room and said, who are our best people? And why do we think they're the best? And what do they do? Like, how are they making decisions? So we started this document and it evolves, right? It's continued to evolve, but we call it our cultural norms. And it is a representation of the best people on their best days. And no one's perfect. Like, I fail all the time on this document, but like, when I'm having my best day, I'm hitting all of these, and it is not the soft and fluffy, like, you know, be nice, you know, like it's like actual actionable things. Like one being, you know, responsiveness. Like, our best people are really, really responsive. And I think that's common across a lot of companies, but like, it's important to us. And so when we have our new employees, Paige and I sit down and we read this document together out loud and share stories. And every employee has to go through this. And every employee exits saying, you've all read this. You're all signing up that you will hold each other accountable to this. And I think it works because, like, I can't be everywhere. Paige can't be everywhere. Matt can't be everywhere. And we all then have this single kind of the testaments of like what it means to work at Flock and how we're going to live these values. And being responsive is one. Being mission oriented is one. You can kind of go down this list of like things that are very uniquely Flock. The other thing that I think has worked well is I'm just on the road nonstop. And when I'm on the road, I'm not only there to visit customers, I'm there to visit employees. And so that gives me a chance to see our people kind of like in real life, not just like, oh, let's grab dinner, but like, let's go visit a customer. Let's go do an install. Let's go do whatever it may be. And I think that even in a hybrid company, you cannot remove the human element of it. And so we have an expectation that every employee will get at least 2 in-person touch points a year, one with their team and one with the whole company. And so I guess I'd say like we tend to be very designed about when are those touch points. I think the general rule of thumb is like you've got about 90 to 180 days before those touch points fade and they lose the impact, that kind of emotion and excitement. So I guess we try to be pretty thoughtful about how we do that.
One of the things that often happens, and I've talked to different folks on the podcast before about this, but sometimes you run into the issue that your senior leaders or people in the organization are better at managing up and communicating than they are doing real substantive work. And I think it's true of any organization. One of your board members told me that you had maybe some interesting thoughts or frameworks about how you go about assessing if people are full of shit and all talk or actually substantive in the work that they're doing.
Yeah, I think the natural tendency for companies is to spend more time talking about work than actually working. Which is like kind of weird, but it starts to happen. Like it's a very natural thing that I've noticed is even happening at Flock. And I think some of it is like, well, if you have enough people, you just have to talk more, which is not desirable, but it happens. For us, the thing that I always look at is, so like a lot of companies, we do some variant of OKRs. But what's different is for us is at the end of that process, we do it once a quarter. We look at, okay, across the executive team, what's the distribution of ownership? And like generally for us, anyone below a director should never own an OKR because it's intended to be a team. It's to be an output that the company cares about. So if it's like it's an IC, that's now like a performance review and that's not the goal. So it should be a director. And I expect anyone pretty much VP and above to own at least one, if not two OKRs every quarter. And when I say own, I expect them actually putting pen to paper. Like not like, oh yeah, I'll manage the team and I'll set the goals. It's like, no. Like real actual work. And one of the ways we're able to do that is like every 2 weeks when we do like a check-in, whoever is the owner is actually one writing the update and it goes to the entire executive team. And it is very, very easy to smell bullshit because you notice that their updates aren't very detailed. Their updates don't have any actual action that was done. And it's like, oh, here's the update on the metric. It's like, yeah, but what did you do? Like, what did you get done in the last 2 weeks as an individual? And when that accountability is coming across their peers versus just me, it sets the bar pretty high. Because now whether it's the general counsel or it's this VP of sales or this VP of Eng, that is really, really, I think, better. We used to do it in a way that I was the one driving this. And now this kind of like peer accountability has leveled the expectations that no one, we're not a big enough company for peer people managers. No one is allowed to just manage people, myself included. I carry a bag and figure out what are the, you know, 5 or 10 deals I can help move across the finish line. What is the 1 or 2 products that I can help push to production? And so for us, it's just like, it's a critical part of who we are.
One of the things I've heard you talk about is the being a macro optimist but micro pessimist within within your business. Can you speak to that? What does that mean? How do you internalize it? How do you go about actionabilizing it?
Yeah, I like the saying. I think it does describe how we act. What it looks like though is it means we never, as a business, talk about success. Like if it's working, why are we talking about it? Just let it go. Let it keep running. And so like, as an executive team, it can be depressing at times because we only talk about problems. We only talk about the things that are failing. But on a local level, on a small time scale, all we should be doing is being worried about the things that are going wrong. And the job, I think, as an executive is to hold two truths that can be opposite, which is I can be incredibly depressed and frustrated and focused on these things that are broken. Well, at the same time, like I just said, I do generally think that in 10 years from now, Flock will have eliminated crime in America. Got a lot of problems I got to go solve later today when we wrap up. But like in 10 years, I think we're going to do great. And like that's because I generally am optimistic for that long-term perspective. But I think that what founders in particular and executives have a problem of doing is when you only present that optimistic perspective, you lose the confidence of your team. Because they're living in the shit every single day of all the problems that are happening. Like they're living in this reality that like, well, this customer's mad and this new product is delayed. And when you go on stage at an all hands and say like, we're a great company. They're like, well, maybe, but my world is a mess. And so we kind of find that balance of saying like, you can be happy and optimistic while saying we have a lot of problems. And like, here's the plan. And so our internal kind of cultural value is optimism, but with a plan. It's okay to be optimistic, but you do actually have to have a plan. Like, because most of the things we are working on are a problem and you can smile about it. But what we have seen people go off track on I think I've worked with a lot of founders as well, where it's like they're optimistic so much so that they lack the plan. And I'm like, oh, like, excited that you think you're going to 10x your business and revenue this year. Do you actually have the pipeline to do that? Do you actually have the headcount, the quota to do that? Like, it's cool that you think you can do it. So it works out well. I'd say the downside to it is we tend to never celebrate milestones. Like, we got to 100 million in ARR in just under 4 years from starting the company. And it was like, I sent a text to our CRO and I was like, nice, good job. And he's like, thanks. And then we had like a slide on all hands. And like, then we just went back to work. It was like, yes, it's working. And it's like, that's kind of a bummer, because I think that I think we could do a better job recognizing that, like, we're working hard. It's generally working. It's a good company. But also, like, I think our success is somewhat from the fact that we don't weigh on our success and we focus on things that are broken.
Yeah. And also, I think to hear you talk about it, and I assume for a lot of your employees, the financial metrics are validating of the mission, but they're not the goal in and of themselves, right? As a standalone. So
I think the last time we checked, the majority, super majority of our employees, this is the first ever venture-backed company they've worked at before. So like, the finances don't even, they almost don't even believe it. Like, when we tell them like, oh, the company's worth X billions of dollars, they're like, I don't even know what that means. That's like irrelevant to me. Like, we have to spend a lot of effort reminding people that this could be financially like very, very, very lucrative for them. It just doesn't, it doesn't matter. They could go get better jobs that pay more today.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I one of the employees that you've had, and I guess you've worked with for a while, is actually your mother, and she is I guess I don't know what her official title is right now. Is she your executive assistant?
That is her title.
Executive assistant to you. How did that come to be? What was that interview process like? And what is it like working with, I've heard a lot of brother sister combos, you know, I guess father son is a lot. I don't know if I know any examples where the mother is working for the son in that way. So definitely,
yes.
First,
I've yet to meet anyone else that's in this dynamic. It's a, like, I'll leave it as a, you know, people should try it maybe more often. So I first started working with my mother when I was 14, I had started a business. I say a business as a gross exaggeration. I started fixing people's computers and getting paid to do it. And one of the challenges is that when I started doing that, I'd make people bring me their computer, and then I'd work on it at my house and then call them and say, hey, you know, your computer is now fixed. Not a lot of people want to drive their computer to you. That's pretty annoying. And so my mom was actually like, hey, you know, I could just drive you to these people's houses and just wait for you. And I was like, well, you know, like, yeah, but, you know, you have a job. This would be taking away from hours you could work. Like, I should just pay you then. And it was really weird. We were like, yeah, I guess, like, logically this all makes sense. So she became my driver, and she would drive me to people's houses and these small businesses, and she'd wait in the car, and I would do my thing, and then just, you know, a piece of the revenue just went straight to her. And this is like, I'm 14, I'm in fifth grade. I'm in sixth or seventh grade. It's really strange in hindsight. Like, we obviously have a very unique relationship. And then she was working at another company when I started Flock. And at the point that I felt like Flock was no longer like a high risk of dying, it's like around our Series B, Series C, when it's like, wow, this thing's like really working. I called her and I was like, we should get the band back together. I want this to be the last place you work. And if you have young kids, and maybe I'm unique here, the biggest stress I have in life is not my job, it's my family. When my kids are sick, when something goes wrong at school, like that's the deepest level of anxiety I exhibit. And so while she's a great admin, like, managing my calendar is not complicated. She doesn't touch my email. She barely manages some calendar, but like, the biggest thing that it provides is I now have a third parent in the equation. And I said before, I travel a lot. I'm gone almost every week. I have a third parent around that actually not only just like loves my kids, but my kids love her. And so I, at least for me, you know, there's this more holistic approach of, for me to be the best version of myself to the company, removing some of the stress from a personal life is actually the biggest gap. She's able to do that. And like in a traditional model, that wouldn't work. But as my mother, it's like, yeah, so she's at my house every day. She works from my house and my kids get to see her. And it's like, I think it's a better quality of life for everyone. So it's pretty unique, but I think yeah. more people should try it.
Yes. I wonder if my mom's listening right now, if she's going to have a request for a job at this point, but it's an interesting dynamic to have that set up.
Performance review season is always a little tricky, but yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. I don't know how that would play out for me, but it's a, I've got, it's, it, I, listen, having, especially when the line blends between EA and PA and, you know, grandmother and, you know, all of that stuff. So I, yeah, it's a, interesting setup, I'm sure, but yeah.
Hey guys, I'm Jacob Efron, a partner of Logan's at Redpoint. Wanted to take a quick break from the episode to let you know that Redpoint's AI podcast, Unsupervised Learning, now has its own YouTube channel. We have an incredible set of guests really at the forefront of the AI revolution. So if you're interested in what's happening in AI, what it means for businesses in the world, definitely subscribe. Now back to the show.
Hey, one of the things I heard you mention was that there's kind of this ethos in Silicon Valley of like the 19-year-old or 20-year-old or 22, whatever it is, going and starting a company right away. And I think a lot of it's rooted in the you have the level of scrappiness and you're less income can be kind of sticky and quality of life can be sticky. And so as you get used to more of the trappings of some level of wealth, your ability to go back in time, I think can be difficult. I had heard you mention that like one of the best experiences you had was actually not starting a company right out of the gates, but instead joining a company in the very early days, but learning from people that have been there, done that. Can you talk about that Silicon Valley ethos of like the Zuckerbergs and the Collisons and the whoever it is that have been sort of the canonical examples of young entrepreneurs versus gaining a little bit of experience and how that benefited you?
Yeah. So I think there's two problems, I think, starting a company when you're like 18 or 21. I think one, you just haven't had a lot of life. And so I think you tend to make pretty bad decisions. And I think there are some people clearly that muscle through it and are just incredibly smart, incredibly good operators. When you think about someone like, you know, Zuckerberg's easy examples, like he just built a great team. He built a great product. Like he figured it out fast enough. I think he is one in a billion. And I think there is a lot to learn from great leaders, great people. And you just wind up being, I think, a better CEO or a better founder when you just have more life experience. I think the second challenge too is you tend to pick pretty dumb ideas when you're that age. You just haven't seen as much business. You haven't seen as much of the world. And so I think about one of my closest friends actually is a pretty young CEO. He fits that bucket. And he's now running a very successful company. It's awesome. But like he went through 4 years of working on totally the wrong idea to then do a massive pivot to a much better idea. And I think that, like, it worked out well for him, but I think that if he was 4 years wiser, 7 years wiser, he never would have gone after the dumb idea because it would have been clear to him that like this is not that actually that interesting of a business to go start. And so I do feel maybe inappropriately strongly about it because it's my own personal experience where I got the benefit of working with some incredible people, watching them build a company. I was the first employee of this company. We then went on to co-found a company together after that one. So learned even more. And by the time, you know, Flock came around, it was the third company I co-founded. And I was like, I feel really comfortable. I'm still a little bit uncomfortable running a company this size. But like beginnings, I'm like, I know what we're working on is a big problem. I know that if this is successful, it could be a really, really big business. And that to me, I don't know, life isn't endless. Like you only get so many shots on goal. And I would hate to waste because if it's successful, right, you're going to go spend 7 to 10 years working on something. Like, God, I would hate to waste any moment on an idea that isn't big enough for at least what I want to do. Obviously, people might have different goals, but like, I have always wanted to build a company that mattered, that like really mattered. And it's hard to do that if you're 18 or 21 or 22.
How old were you when you started Flock?
29, 30.
You had a couple exits, right?
Yeah.
I think $200 million exits, and it sounds like you took some time off and maybe got your handicap down from a golf game standpoint. Like what? Yes. That period of time, it's a weird thing, I think, to have success early and especially to have been through the mission of the company, right? The business had sold and you had been through a lot of that. Maybe that moment in time and, I don't know, quarter life crisis or a existential consideration. Was that a moment of sort of reckoning, of like, hey, what am I going to do from here? I've accomplished what I maybe dreamed of far earlier than I expected. What was that moment in time like?
It was definitely uncomfortable in hindsight. Because to your point, my wife and I had kind of accomplished the financial things we really wanted to do. And professionally, I'd accomplished at least partially the things I wanted to do. And to your early question on like people versus team versus market, the first business was in what would now be called fintech. Second business was in live events and sports, built another business in automotive. And what I had noticed is, it was always with people that I liked working with. And I guess what I kind of came down to the conclusion is like, there's only one thing I can actually control, which is who I spend time with. And I want to go spend time with people that I like working with. And the easiest way to do that is to go build a company. Sort of forces us to work together. And I think what I'd also come to a conclusion of was selling companies is great, but you do lose control. It's no longer your company. And I get the question all the time from our employees of like, oh, would you ever sell Flock? And it's like, yeah, I mean, I have a fiduciary responsibility to our shareholders, which is all of our employees, myself, our investors. But man, it's really fun to run this company.
Yeah.
What would I do then? Just go start another company?
Yeah.
Like, I like the people I work with. Like, I think I've built a really good team. I love my co-founders. I love our customers. Like, well, what would I do next? Like, I don't know. I've got too many things that are unsolved here. And so I guess for me, like, it's been fun because at least in the last two companies, we sold them because we actually kind of achieved the mission. Like, we built the product. We got market share. They were small in terms of revenue, but it wasn't as if we had 10 years of roadmap waiting to be built. Whereas at Flock, man, I have so many things I want to go do. And we're farther ahead in revenue than I would say our impact. I think there's so much left undone. And so for me, what I'm now realizing in hindsight is like, this was a calling for me. And I have the right kind of DNA or makeup to do all the political stuff that has to be done to deal with local and state government and federal government and enough engineering prowess to like build the original product and like kind of Goldilocks type situation. And also the skin these days that's thick enough to weather the hit pieces day after day after day, knowing that we're doing better for the world. So yeah, it was a weird time and really like appreciative. I had a very supportive wife who pushed me in this direction. Of effectively like, hey, get off your butt, stop playing golf and like go build something again. Like you're a builder, go build.
Yeah. Sounds like a good critic and also a good nudge along the way. I think that we're all appreciative of her service to doing that. One of the things I think that I had heard and we had discussed a little bit before we started recording was that you specifically didn't want to start. I think dopey was the term that you used, and maybe your uncle was the motivator. Behind doing that. So in your mind, like, what does that actually mean? Not starting a dopey company. And how did that like help influence the decision to go after Flock?
Yeah. My uncle was my, my closest mentor, and he was always very, very good with words. And he coined the term for me of like, don't go build another dopey business, calling the last three companies I had started quite dopey, which, you know, okay. Now, but his point was, you know, he had built a black box trading company. And while he loved the team and they had an incredible team, like loved the people, the business was moving bits around, making money, but like zero incremental value to the world. Zero. Maybe negative. And I think that weighed on him. And his advice to me was like, you should go build something that you're really, really proud of. Not proud of just the team, because of course you'll build a great team. That's kind of like a requirement. But like one that if you left and the team left, you'd be like, man, that mattered. And that was our only filter for Paige and Matt and I, of like all the ideas we were thinking about building, it had to be one that wasn't dopey. And we've shared a few stories together of some of the success Flock has had on the impact side. And like, those are not dopey. And every day we see those stories, and not every company gets that. You know, you think about a company, I like to pick on Salesforce because they're wildly successful. If Salesforce disappeared tomorrow, who cares? No one would care. We'd all switch to HubSpot, or we'd switch to whatever the next CRM winds up being. But it's just a CRM. That's it. It's just a piece of software. And like, it's very hard, I think, once you've tasted something like Flock, to go back to that. I think it's really hard because you realize that your skills as a technologist, whether you're an engineer or a marketer or in sales, or someone like yourself who deploys capital, God, it is way more fun to be involved in a business that really changes people's lives. And like really does it. Not the like hand waving. That's one of the reasons why I think we've been successful fundraising. So at the end of the day, you're a human too. You're a dad, you're a husband, you're a partner. You've got grandparents and parents and friends. And when you explain this crazy AI product that doesn't actually really do anything, but it's going to be a great investment, you're excited because that's your job. You do have to go return capital to LPs, but you're so much more proud and excited when the company you're partnering with or working with is actually easy to explain and makes an impact. And that's, you know, one of the things that we hold very dearly.
It sounds like you all had a fairly serendipitous journey on fundraising, going to YC, and you know, you had good investors from the start. I think Bedrock, Initialize, Matrix, like a bunch of people initially. But there was this this point that I think almost every company goes through. Stripe is maybe the exception, but almost every company has like a shitty fundraising round that they really struggle to get done, I guess. Can you talk through the circumstances around being 3 months away from running out of capital and the business doing well, but for the first time, like it may be coming a little more difficult to fundraise? Like what were the circumstances around that? And are there lessons that can be extrapolated for the entrepreneur listening?
Yeah. I always felt like I had a pretty good pulse on the investor market and like how people perceived the business. I think what I got wrong is there are certain points in time where the investor class changes, and with that perspective on a business changes. And I think Series B and probably let's call it like pre-IPO/IPO are those two trigger points where like at a Series B investment, I'm now learning this in hindsight, it's not just the story anymore. Like the metrics really matter. Because in a seed or Series A investment, it's like pretty easy to underwrite to a 10 to 100x return. Like everything about it in my pitch to Gary and Alexis at Initialize, they're like, do you think this thing can get to 100 million in ARR? And I was like, yeah, let me show you why. And it's like on a napkin, you can say, well, there's 400,000 neighborhoods in America. I think they all probably like want to be safe. The average neighborhood spends $10,000 with us. So like, yeah, I think I can get to $100 million in ARR. And they're like, cool. Then this is an easy, then like, we love the story. This is, we can underwrite this really easily. And I think even at Series A, they're just looking for a little bit more traction, but it's the same pitch, which is like, can this thing get to 100, 200 million in ARR? And therefore like, this is a good investment. What I noticed at least in Series B is like, that wasn't enough anymore. Because now you're talking about a price point on a business that you got to believe pretty significant revenue growth is still ahead of it. Pretty significant like moats in the business that like you can block out competitors, because if you're seeing success, someone's going to come behind you. And so this like the most memorable thing was we never really had like a data room, right? Like we were very much emotional triggered and investing. You get people really excited about the product, the concept, and the traction of the business, and not a lot of data. And we were like laughed out of the room by these later stage investors who were like, your data is trash. You have nothing. Like, where's your NRR waterfall? And I was like, what's an NRR waterfall? It's like, we're growing fast. That's all I know. We went from 1 million to 6 million in ARR in a year. And we went from 6 million to 17 million this year. Give me money. I'm not worried about the details. Like, I just think we have a lot of space. And what I didn't realize is that my job was becoming the storyteller of how our TAM is growing, how our penetration in the markets that we're in is defensible. Like my job had changed and I hadn't realized it. And I didn't pivot fast enough. And so to your point, we were down to about 2 or 3 months of runway, and only two of us in the company knew, Sky John and I, who was running finance at the time. And it was scary. No one had any idea that like we were at pretty big risk of not hitting payroll. The investor community had given up on the business. I don't look fondly back on that period of time. We wound up having to do a kind of a mini riff layoff type thing. We had to like go all the way down to bare bottoms to extend runway. And I had to call Gary back at Initialize and say like, hey, I need $20 million. And he was like, I've got 7. I was like, well, that's not, that's like less than half of 20, Gary. He was like, yeah, but like, we're a seed stage investor. This is already a bit of a stretch for us. And to his credit, he believed when a lot of other people didn't. And he got a great price because I had no negotiating leverage at that point. So I think we were at about 16 million in ARR and he invested at a $100 million valuation. And we had tripled the business the prior year and we wound up tripling the business again, which we said we were going to do. And everyone said, that's impossible. You're selling hardware. This company's going to flatten out. You don't know what you're doing. And we wound up proving everyone wrong. And I don't really even understand. We put up another quarter of good results. And what was different is I then told John, who's in charge of our finance at the time, I was like, dude, we're going to run out of money. So I chose, even though Gary only gave me 7, I pretended like he gave me 20. I spent it like he gave me 20. and so I knew we were only going to have probably like 3 to 6 months of runway. Again, like before we would need to fundraise, like we were going to have to go back out to market. And I took the feedback from the investors like seriously, which was like, your data room doesn't match the story. The data you're giving us does not match what we're seeing on the top line. And so we spent a bunch of time like redoing that. And the business continued to put up good numbers. The business was scaling and it felt like we were an entirely different company.
In every round, I mean, since then, as I unfortunately well know, has been very competitive, and you've had more interest than need for capital. And was it really just I mean, there was some inflection point clearly you hit from a scale standpoint that was probably threshold. But was it really just the storytelling and the presentation of all of it? You just got crisper in that. And therefore, I mean, the venture community can be sheep in a lot of ways, of like sort of falling in line around stuff. But is there anything else around that?
Well, I think there's a few things, right? Like, and I think this is relevant to a lot of entrepreneurs if they're trying to serve a vertical that has not been attacked by venture successfully. Although I had prior success, like in terms of the growth of the business, we got zero credit for future goals. And the reason why, I think it's fair, because like they're saying, like, well, who do you peer against? Who should I look to as an investor to see what's possible? And every other company we were competing with, you know, like Axon, was bootstrapped. And it took Axon, you know, 17 years to go public, and it's a 30-something year old company now. And like, it's just like, it's a beautiful business, but man, it took almost 40 years to get there.
Yeah.
That's not venture. It's a great business, but it's not venture. And you look at Motorola, our other biggest competitor, and that's a 100-plus-year-old company. So as an investor, you're going like, oh, I can't really underwrite to your future goals because you're saying that, but who do I look to? So I do think, to your point, at a certain point, people just started to believe me. Because I said, hey, look, we're going to go from 16, 17 million to 50 million in ARR. People were like, you're out of your freaking mind. And I was like, ah, I think that's the plan. Like, I think we're going to hit this plan. And you put up a quarter or two on that trajectory, and everyone's like, he might be right. Like, this actually might work. And his numbers do seem pretty high, but like, he seems to be hitting numbers. The company seems to be tracking. And so I think there was an inflection point where the investor community stopped disagreeing with us and said, maybe these guys just actually deeply understand this market better than we do. It's bigger than we ever expected. And they've clearly figured out a way to attack it. And so every single fundraise, every single quarter, you know, I think as a business, it took 6 years to have our first ever quarter that wasn't net larger in ARR growth, if that makes sense. Like, we mm-hmm. never yeah. had down, not a down quarter on ARR, like a down quarter on the velocity of bookings.
Yeah.
And so I think that was just the other one, is like the lack of a pattern to follow or like a proxy to look to. And even today, as a larger company, when we get the question of like, oh, who do you view as public comps? It's kind of, we don't, Samsara, I guess, but like, yeah. they serve a totally different vertical. We have a lot of commonalities in terms of our metrics. And so I do think that is it hard to overcome until you hit some scale.
Yeah. 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 Well, Garrett, thank you for doing this. This was
awesome.
A really fun conversation, and it's a incredible business you're building. I would not categorize it as dopey. So
I appreciate
your uncle,
that.
Yeah, yeah. Your uncle can be proud that he motivated you in a good direction here.
I think so too. What I appreciate it is great to spend some time together.
Thank you for listening to this conversation with Garrett Langley, co-founder and CEO of Flock Safety, a really impressive individual building a really important company. If you enjoyed this discussion with Garrett, please do share with anyone else that you think might find it interesting. And please subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening on. Each additional subscription helps us drive more listeners, which ultimately leads to our goal of bringing on better guests each subsequent week. And so your help is really appreciated. You'll hear another great guest here next week, and we look forward to seeing you back on the Logan Bartlett Show.